Chapter 11. The Refit. Books suffer wear and tear, just the same as hip joints, cars, and reputations. For this reason, all books have to go into the maintenance bay for a periodic refit, either every 30 years or every million readings, whichever comes first. For those books that suffer a high initial readership, but then lose it through boredom or insufficient reader intellect, a partial refit may be in order. Salmon Thrusty's intractable masterpiece, The Demonic Couplets, has had its first two chapters rebuilt 6 times, but the rest is relatively unscathed. Ever since the Procaths had mounted a guerrilla-style attack on Wuthering Heights during routine maintenance, security had been increased, and tall, cast-iron railings now separated the book maintenance facility from the rest of the well. Heathcliff, possibly the most hated man inside fiction, had not been harmed, partly due to the vigilance of the jurisfiction agents who were on Heathcliff protection duty that day, but also due to a misunderstanding of the word guerrilla, a woeful lexicological lapse that had left 5 confused apes dead and the facility littered with bananas. There was now a guardhouse, too, and it was impossible to get in unless on official business. "Now, here's an opportunity," I whispered to Thursday 5, "to test your aggressiveness. These guys can be tricky, so you need to be firm." "Firm? Firm." She took a deep breath, steeled herself, and marched up to the guardhouse in a meaningful manner. "Next and next," she announced, passing our IDs to a guard who was sitting in a small wooden shed at the gates of the facility. "And if you cause us any trouble, we'll not be happy. And then you'll not be happy, because we can do unhappy things to people. Sometimes." "I'm sorry," said the guard, who had a large white moustache and seemed to be a little deaf. "I said, how are you?"
"Oh, we're fine, thank you, missy," replied the guard amiably.
Thursday 5 turned to me and gave me the thumbs-up sign, and I smiled. I actually quite liked her, but there was a huge quantity of work to be done before she might be considered jurisfiction material. At present, I was planning on assessing her potential with retraining and sending her back to cadet school. I looked around as the guard stared at our identification and then at us. Above the hangars, I could see tall chimneys belching forth clouds of smoke, while in the distance we could hear the ring of hammers and the rumble of machinery.
"Which one is Thursday next?" asked the guard, staring closely at the almost identical IDs.
"Both of us," said Thursday 5. "I'm Thursday 5, and she's the Outlander."
"An Outlander?" repeated the guard with great interest.
I glared at Thursday 5. My Outlander status wasn't something I liked to bandy about.
"Hey, Bert,"
he said to the other guard, who seemed to be on permanent tea break.
"We've got an Outlander here."
"No,"
he said, getting up from a chair that had its seat polished to a high shine.
"Get out of here."
"What an honor," said the first guard. "Someone from the real world."
He thought for a moment.
"Tell me, if it rains on a really hot day, do sheep shrink?"
"Is that a security question?"
"No, no," replied the guard quickly. "Bert and I were just discussing it recently."
This wasn't unusual. Characters in fiction had a very skewed view of the real world. To them, the extreme elements of human experience were commonplace, as they were generally the sorts of issues that made it into books, which left the mundanities of real life somewhat obscure and mysterious. Ask a resident of the book world about terminal diseases, loss, gunshot trajectories, dramatic irony, and problematic relatives, and he'd be more expert than you or me. Quiz him on paintbrushes, and he'd spend the rest of the week trying to figure out how the paint stays on the bristles until it touches another surface. "It's woolens that shrink," I explained, "and it has to be very hot."
"I told you so," said Bert triumphantly.
"Thank you," I said,
taking the security badges from the guard while I signed the ledger. He admitted us both to the facility, and almost from nowhere a bright yellow Jeep appeared with a young man dressed in blue overalls and a cap sporting the BMF logo. "Can you take us to Isambard Kingdom Buñuel?" I said as we climbed in the back. "Yes," replied the driver without moving. "Then would you?"
"I suppose."
The Jeep moved off. The hangars were, as previously stated, of gigantic proportions. Unlike the real world, where practical difficulties in civil engineering might be a defining factor in the scale of a facility, here it was not a consideration at all. Indeed, the size of the plant could expand and contract depending on need, a little like Mary Poppins's suitcase, which was hardly surprising, as they were designed by the same person. We drove on for a time in silence. "What's in Hangar 1 at the moment?" I asked the driver.
"The Magus."
"Still?" Even the biggest refit never took more than a week, and John Fowles's labyrinthine-plotted masterpiece had been in there nearly 5.
"It's taking longer than we thought. They removed all the plot elements for cleaning, and no one can remember how they go back together again."
"I'm not sure it will make a difference," I murmured as we pulled up outside Hangar 8. The driver said nothing, waited until we climbed out, and then drove off without a word. To say that the interior of the hangar was vast would have been pointless, as the Great Library, Text Grand Central, and the C of G also had vast interiors, and continued descriptions of an increasingly hyperbolic nature would be insufferably repetitious. Suffice it to say that there was room on the hangar floor for not only Darcy's country home of Pemberley, but also Rosings, Netherfield, and Longbourn as well. They had all been hoisted from the book by a massive overhead crane, so the empty husk of the novel could be checked for fatigue cracks before being fumigated for nesting grammar sites and then repainted. At the same time, an army of technicians, plasterers, painters, carpenters, and so forth were crawling over the houses, locations, props, furnishings, and costumes, all of which had been removed for checking and maintenance.
"If this is Pride and Prejudice," said Thursday 5, as we walked toward the Bennetts' property of Longbourn, "then what are people reading in the outland?"
The house was resting incongruously on wooden blocks laid on the hangar floor, but without its grounds. They were elsewhere, being tended to by a happy buzz of gardeners. "We divert the readings to a lesser copy on a standby story code engine, and people read that," I replied, nodding a greeting to the various technicians who were trying to make good the damage wrought by the last million readings or so. "The book is never quite as good, but the only people who might see a difference are the Austin enthusiasts and scholars. They would notice the slight dulling and lack of vitality, but, unable to come to a satisfactory answer as to why this might be so, they will simply blame themselves. A reading later in the week will once again renew their confidence in the magnificence of the novel." We stepped inside the main doorway of Longbourn, where a similar repair gang was working on the interior. They had only just gotten started, and from here it was easier to see the extent of the corrosion. The paintwork was dull and lifeless, the wallpaper hung off the wall in long strips, and the marble fireplace was stained and darkened by smoke. Everything we looked at seemed tired and worn.
"Oh, mercy!" came a voice behind us, and we turned to find Mrs. Bennett, dressed in a threadbare poke bonnet and shawl. Following her was a construction manager, and behind him was Mr. Bennett. "This will never be ready in time," she lamented, looking around the parlour of her house unhappily. "And every second not spent looking for husbands is a second wasted."
"My dear, you must come and have your wardrobe replaced," implored Mr. Bennett. "You are quite in tatters, and unsuited for being read, let alone receiving gentlemen, potential husbands or otherwise."
"He's quite right," urged the manager. "It's only a refit, nothing more. We will have you back on the shelf in a few days."
"On the shelf?" she shrieked. "Like my daughters."
And she was about to burst into tears when she suddenly caught sight of me.
"You there! Do you have a single brother in possession of a good fortune who is in want of a wife?"
"I'm afraid not," I replied, thinking of Joffy, who failed on all three counts.
"Are you sure? I've a choice of 5 daughters. One of them must be suitable. Although I have my doubts about Mary being acceptable to anyone."
She started to scream.
"Good lady, calm yourself," cried Mr. Bennet. "Whatever is the matter?"
"My nerves are so bad, I'm now seeing double."
"You are not, madam," I told her hastily. "This is my twin sister." At that moment, a small phalanx of seamstresses came in holding a replacement costume. Mrs. Bennet made another sharp cry and ran off upstairs, quickly followed by the wardrobe department, who would doubtless have to hold her down and undress her, like the last time.
"I'll leave it in your capable hands," said Mr. Bennet to the wardrobe mistress. "I am going to my library, and don't wish to be disturbed."
He opened the door and found to his dismay that it too was being rebuilt. Large portions of the wall were missing, and plasterers were attempting to fill the gaps to the room beyond. There was the flickering light of an arc welder and a shower of sparks. He harrumphed, shrugged, gave us a wan smile, and walked out. "Quite a lot of damage," I said to the construction manager, whose name we learned was Sid.
"We get a lot of this in the classics," he said with a shrug. "This is the third P2 refit I've done in the past 15 years. But it's not as bad as the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Those things are always in for maintenance. The fantasy readership really gives it a hammering, and the fan fiction doesn't help neither."
"The name's Thursday Next," I told him, "from Juris Fiction. I need to speak to Isambard." He led us outside to where the 5 Bennet sisters were running through their lines with a wordsmith holding a script. "But you are not entitled to know mine, nor will such behaviour ever induce me to be explicit," said Elizabeth.
"Not quite right," replied the wordsmith, as she consulted the script. "You dropped the 'as this' from the middle of the sentence."
"I did?" queried Lizzie, craning over to look at the script. "Where?"
"It still sounded perfect to me," said Jane good-naturedly.
"This is all just so boring," muttered Lydia,
tapping her foot impatiently and looking round. Wisely, the maintenance staff had separated the soldiers, and especially Wickham, from Kitty and Lydia, for their own protection, if not the soldiers.
"Lydia, dearest, do please concentrate," said Mary, looking up from the book she was reading. "It is for your own good."
"Ms. Next,"
came an authoritarian voice that I knew I could ignore only at my peril.
"Your ladyship," I said, curtsying neatly to a tall woman bedecked in dark crinolines. She had strongly marked features that might once have been handsome, but now appeared haughty and superior.
"May I present Cadet Next?" I said. "Thursday 5, this is the Right Honourable Lady Catherine de Bourgh, widow of Sir Louis de Bourgh." Thursday 5 was about to say something, but I caught her eye, and she curtsied instead, which Lady Catherine returned with a slight incline of her head.
"I must speak to you, Miss Next," continued her ladyship, taking my arm to walk with me, "upon a matter of considerable concern. As you know, I have a daughter named Anne, who is unfortunately of a sickly constitution, which has prevented her from making accomplishments she otherwise could not have failed. If good health had been hers, she would have joined Juris Fiction many years ago, and about now would begin to accrue the benefits of her age, wisdom, and experience."
"Doubtless, your ladyship."
Lady Catherine gave a polite smile.
"Then we are agreed. Miss Anne should join Juris Fiction on the morrow with a rank, salary, and duties commensurate with the standing that her ill health has taken from her. Shall we say 5,000 guineas a year, and light work only with mornings off and 3 servants?"
"I will bring it to the attention of the relevant authorities," I told her diplomatically. "My good friend and colleague, Commander Bradshaw, will attend to your request personally." I sniggered inwardly. Bradshaw and I had spent many years attempting to drop each other in impossible situations for amusement, and he'd never top this.
"Indeed," said Lady Catherine in an imperious tone. I spoke to Commander Bradshaw, and he suggested I speak to you.
Ah,
shall we say Monday?
Continued Lady Catherine.
Jurisfiction can send a carriage for my daughter, but be warned. If it is unfit for her use, it shall be returned.
Monday would be admirable, I told her, thinking quickly. Miss Anne's assumed expertise will be much in demand. As you have no doubt heard, Fanny Hill has been moved from literary smut to the racy novel genre, and your daughter's considerable skills may be required for character retraining. Lady Catherine was silent for a moment.
Quite impossible, she said at last. Next week is the busiest in our calendar. I shall inform you as to when and where she will accept her duties. Good day!
And with a harumph of a most haughty nature, she was gone. I rejoined Thursday Five, who was waiting for me near two carriages that were being rebuilt, and then we made our way toward the engineer's office. As we passed a moth-eaten horse, I heard it say to another shabby old nag,
"So, what's this Pride and Prejudice all about, then?"
"It's about a horse who pulls a carriage for the Bennets," replied his friend, taking a mouthful from the feed bucket and munching thoughtfully.
"Please come in," said the construction manager, and we entered the work hut. The interior was a neat and orderly drawing office, with a half-dozen octopi seated at draftsmen's desks and dressed in tartan waistcoats that made them all look like oversized bagpipes, apart from one, who actually was an oversized set of bagpipes. They were all studying plans of the book, consulting damage reports, and then sketching repair recommendations on 8 different notepads simultaneously. The octopi blinked at us curiously as we walked in, except for one who was asleep and muttering something about his garden being in the shade, and another who was playing a doleful tune on a bouzouki.
"How odd," said Thursday Five.
"You're right," I agreed. "Bruce usually plays the lute." In the center of the room was Isambard Kingdom Bunuel. He was standing in shirt sleeves over the blueprints of the book, and was a man in healthy middle age, who looked as if he had seen a lot of life and was much the better for it. His dark wool suit was spattered with mud. He wore a tall stovepipe hat, and moving constantly in his mouth was an unlit cigar. He was engaged in animated conversation with his 3 trusty engineering assistants. The first could best be described as a mad monk who was dressed in a coarse habit and had startling divergent eyes. The second was a daringly sparkly drag queen who it seemed had just hopped off a carnival float in Rio. And the third was more ethereal. He was simply a disembodied voice known only as Horace. They were all discussing the pros and cons of balancing essential work with budgetary constraints. Then about Loretta's choice of sequins and the available restaurants for dinner.
"Thursday," said Isambard as we walked in. "What a very fortuitous happenstance. I trust you are well healthy?"
"Well healthy indeedly," I replied. Bouillonnel's engineering skills were without peer, not just from a simple mechanistic point of view, but also from his somewhat surreal method of problem-solving that made lesser book engineers pale into insignificance. It was he who first thought of using custard as a transfer medium for speedier throughput from the books to the story code engines, and he who pioneered the hydroponic growth of usable dramatic irony. When he wasn't working toward the decriminalization of Class C grammatical abuses, such as starting a sentence with "and," he was busy designing new and interesting plot devices. It was he who suggested the groundbreaking twist in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and also the Galley Threepwood memoirs, device in the Blandings series. Naturally, he'd had other lesser ideas that didn't find favor, such as the discarded U-boat Nautilus battle sequence in Mysterious Island, a new process for distilling quotation marks from boiled mice, a method of making books grammarcite-proof by marinating them in dew, and a whole host of farcical new words that only he used.
but his hits were greater than the sum of his misses, and such is the way with greatness.
I hope we're not in any sort of trouble with jurisfiction.
Not at all, I assured him. You spoke to Bradshaw about something?
My memory is so string-bagginess these days, he said, slapping his forehead with his palm. Walk with me.
We left the work hut at a brisk pace and walked toward the empty book, Thursday Five a few steps behind.
We've got another 17 clock chimes before we have to click it all back onwise, he said, mopping his brow.
Will you manage it?
We should be dokey, replied Isambard with a laugh, always supposing that Mrs. Bennet doesn't do anything sensible.
We walked up a set of wooden stairs and stepped onto the novel. From our vantage point, we could see the empty husk of the book laid out in front of us. Everything had been removed, and it looked like an empty steel barge several hundred acres in size.
"What's happening over there?" asked Thursday Five, pointing to a group of men working in an area where several girders joined in a delicate latticework of steel and rivets.
"We're check-looking for fatigue split cracks near the irony expansion slot," exclaimed Isambard. "The ceaseless flexibilations of a book as readers of varying skill make their way through it can set up a harmonic that exacts stresstications the book was never blueprinted to take. I expect you heard about the mid-read fractoplosion of Hard Times during the post-maintenance testification in 1932?
Thursday Five nodded.
We've had to be more utter carefulness since then, continued Isambard, which is why classics like this come in for rebuildificants every 30 years, whether they require it or not.
There was a crackle of bright blue light as the work gang effected a repair, and a sub-engineer supervising the gang waved to Isambard, who waved back.
Looks like we found a fatigue crevicette, he said, which goes to show that one can never be too careful-phobic.
Commander Bradshaw told me you had something you wanted to say.
That's true, replied Buñuel. I've done enough rebuildificances to know when something's a bit squiddly. It's the Council of Genres. They've been slice-dicing budgets for years, and now they ask us to top-grade the imagino-transference conduits.
He pointed at a large pipe that looked like a water main. A conduit that size would take a lot of readers, far more than we had at present. Although, in itself a good move, with falling reader rates, it seemed a little, well, odd.
Did they give a reason?
They said Pride and Prejudice has been added to 28 more Teach Crammar syllabuses this year, and there's another Silver Flick out soon.
Sounds fair to me.
Post-truthful, but it makes nonsense.
It's pretentious new books we should be cash-squandering on, not the stall novel warts who will be read no matter what. Besides, the cost cash of the extra conduits is ver little compared to the amount of custard needed to fill up all.
I'll make some inquiries, I told him. We watched as the overhead crane gently lowered Darcy's stately home of Pemberley back into its position in the book, where it was then securely bolted by a group of men in overalls wielding wrenches as big as they were.
Spot on time-tastic, murmured Isambard, consulting a large gold pocket watch. We might make the dead Yule after all.
Mr. Buñuel, murmured a disembodied voice that sounded as though it came from everywhere at once.
Yes, Horace?
Sorry to trouble you, sir, came the voice again, but Mrs. Bennet and Lady Catherine de Bourgh have locked antlers in the living room and are threatening to kill each other. What do you want to do?
No time to lose, exclaimed Buñuel, reaching into his pocket. I'll have 5 guineas on Mrs. Bennet.
Thursday Five and I walked out of the maintenance facility and back to the busy corridors of the Well of Lost Plots. I called trans-genre taxis and was told that my cab was stuck in a traffic jam in Mrs. Beaton's, but would be with you shortly. So we walked toward the elevators. Buñuel had a point about the extra conduiting, but equally, it could be just another of the bizarre accounting anomalies that abound at the Council. They once refused to allocate funds for maintenance on Captain Corelli's mandolin, despite an almost unprecedented burst of popularity.
By the time they agreed to some remedial construction work, it was too late. The first few chapters suffered permanent damage. On the other side of the coin, they had no problem issuing the Danvers with new black uniforms and designer dark glasses so they looked nice on parade.
"Is it true you have a chair at the Council of Genres?" asked Thursday Five, with a sense of wholly unwarranted awe in her voice.
"And a table, too. As an outlander, I don't have the strictures of the narrative to dictate my actions, so I'm quite good at forward planning and..." "Hang on a moment."
Recalling Landon's writer's block, I ducked into a bric-a-brac store full of plot devices, props, backstories, and handy snatches of verbal banter for that oh-so-important exchange. I made my way past packing cases full of plot twists and false resolutions, and walked up to the counter. "Hello, Murray."
"Thursday," replied the owner of the store, a retired gag-and-groan man who had worked the comedy genre for years before giving it all up to run a used plot shop.
"What can I do you for?"
"A plot device," I said, somewhat vaguely.
"Something exciting that will change a story from the mundane to the fantastic in a paragraph."
"Budget?"
"Depends on what you've got."
Said the shopkeeper, thinking hard and staring at the wall of small drawers behind him, which made it look like an apothecary's shop. On each drawer there was a painted label denoting some exciting and improbable plot-turning device. "Tincture of breathlessness," said one, and "paternal root," read another.
"How about a suddenly a shot rang out? That's always a safe bet for mysteries, or to get you out of a scrape when you don't know what to do next."
"I think I can afford something better than that. Got anything a bit more complex?"
Murray looked at the labels on the drawers again.
"I've got a..."
"And that," said Mr. Wimple, "was when we discovered the truth."
"Too vague."
"Perhaps, but it's cheap."
"Okay, how about a mysterious stranger arriving during a thunderstorm? We've got a special on this week. Take the stranger, and you can have a corrupt local chief of police and an escaped homicidal lunatic at no extra charge."
But I was still undecided. I was thinking of something more character than plot-led.
"I hope you've got deep pockets," said the shopkeeper ominously and with a trace of annoyance, as the line behind me was becoming longer by the second.
"How about the arrival of a distant and extremely eccentric ex-military uncle, upsetting the delicate balance of the ordered household?"
"That sounds like just the thing. How much?"
"He was pulled out complete and unused a few days ago. Took a lot of skill to pluck him out of the narrative without damage, and with all ancillary props and walk-ons."
"Yes, okay, I get the picture. How much?"
"To you, 1,000 guineas.
"I get the uncle fully realized for that, yes?"
"He's over there."
I turned to see a slender and very jovial-looking gentleman sitting on a packing case on the other side of the shop. He was dressed in a suit of outrageously loud green and yellow checks, and was resting his gloves on the top of a cane. He inclined his head in greeting when he saw us looking at him, and smiled impishly.
"Perfect. I get a full backstory as well, yes?"
"It's all here," said Murray, placing on the counter a glass jar that seemed to be full of swirling coloured mist.
"Then it's a deal."
We shook hands, and I gave him my Book World charge card. I was just standing there, in that blank sort of way you do while waiting for a shopkeeper to complete a transaction, when the hair on the back of my neck suddenly rose. It was a sixth sense, if you like, something you acquire in the book world, where jeopardy is sometimes never more than a line away. I surreptitiously slipped my hand into my bag and clasped the butt of my pistol. I looked cautiously from the corner of my eye at the customer to my left. It was a freelance imaginator buying powdered kabuki. No problem there. I looked to the right and perceived a tall figure dressed in a trench coat with a fedora pulled down to hide his face. I tensed as the faint odor of bovine reached my nostrils. It was the Minotaur,
the half-man, half-bull son of Queen Persephone of Crete. He'd killed one jurisfiction agent and tried the same with me several times. So consequently, he had an erase-on-sight order across 16 genres. There were few these days who would dare harbour him. I stayed calm and turned toward Thursday Five, who was looking at a pair of toucans that were a job lot from a scrapped bird identification handbook. I caught her eye and showed her three fingers, which was a prearranged signal of imminent danger, then gave an almost imperceptible nod in the Minotaur's direction. Thursday Five looked bewildered. I gave up and turned slowly back.
"Soon be done," muttered Murray, filling out the credit form.
I stole a look toward the Minotaur again. I could have erased him there and then, but it was always possible that this wasn't the Minotaur we were hunting. After all, there were thousands of Minotaurs dotted around the book world, and they all looked pretty much alike. Admittedly, not many wore trench coats and fedoras, but I wasn't going to dispatch anyone without being sure.
"Would you like that frying pan wrapped, Mr. Johnson?" asked the lady serving the Minotaur.
I required nothing more. He'd been using the Mr. Johnson pseudonym for many years, and the frying pan? Well, we darted him once with slapstick as a tracking device, and it seemed to have crept into his modus operandi of assassination. Steamrollers, banana skins, falling pianos, he'd used them all. In the pantheon of slapstick, the close quarters hand weapon of choice was a frying pan. Without waiting another second, I drew my pistol. The Minotaur, with a speed out of all proportion to his bulk, flipped the frying pan to his other hand and swiped it in my direction, catching the pistol and sending it clattering to the other side of the room. We paused and stared at each other. The frying pan had a 2-foot handle, and he brandished it at me in a threatening manner. He removed his hat, and as the other customers realized who he was, there was a cry of fear and a mass exodus from the shop. He had the body of a man, but the head of a bull, which had a kind of humanness about it that was truly disturbing. His yellow eyes gleamed at me with malevolence, and his horns, I noticed, had been sharpened to wickedly fine points.
"We can talk about this," I said, in a quiet tone,
wondering if Thursday Five had the wits to try to distract him.
"No talk," said the Minotaur in a basso profundo. "My job is to kill you, and yours is to die."
I tried to stall him.
"Let's talk for a minute about job descriptions."
But the Minotaur wasn't in the talking vein. He took a pace forward and made another swipe at me with the frying pan. I took a step backward, but even so felt the breeze of the pan as it just missed my head. I grabbed the object nearest to hand, which was a golf club, and tried to hit him with it, but he was faster, and the wooden shaft of the club was reduced to splinters and sawdust with the ferocity of his blow. He gave out another deep, hearty laugh and took a further step toward me.
"I say," came a voice that sounded like crumpets and tea at 4 o'clock sharp. "You, sir, with the horns."
The Minotaur looked to where the voice had come from, but still kept me within his vision. The interloper, of course, was the eccentric relative I'd just purchased for Landon's book. He had left his packing case and stood facing the beast, armed with nothing more than his walking stick.
"Now, run along, there's a good chap," he said, as though he were talking to a child.
The Minotaur curled a lip and breathed a threatening,
"Be gone."
"Look here," replied the character in the green and yellow checks. "I'm not sure I care for the tone of your voice."
The Minotaur was suddenly a whirling mass of demonic destruction. He swung the frying pan toward the gentleman in an arc that could never have missed. But he did miss. There was a flash of silver, a blur of green and yellow, and the frying pan clattered to the floor, with the Minotaur's hand still clutching it. The Minotaur looked at the frying pan, at the severed hand, then at his stump. He grimaced, gave out a deafening yell that shattered the windows of the shop, and then evaporated into nothing as he jumped off and away.
"By
"Gad, what a to-do!" exclaimed the gentleman, as he calmly cleaned his sword-stick and returned it to his sheath. "Anyone know who he was?"
"The Minotaur."
"Was he, by George?" exclaimed the gentleman in surprise. "Would have expected a better fight than that. Are you quite well?"
"Yes," I answered, "thanks to you. That was a nifty piece of sword-work."
"My dear girl, think nothing of it," he replied with the ghost of a smile. "I was captain of the fencing team at Rugby."
He was a handsome man in his mid-40s, and everything he did and said was liberally iced with a heavy coating of stiff British reserve. I couldn't imagine what book he had come from, or even why he'd been offered up as salvage.
"Thursday next," I said, putting out my hand.
"The pleasure is all mine, Miss Next," he replied. "Wing Commander Cornelius Scampton Tappet, at your service." The customers were slowly coming back to peer into the store, but Murray was already placing closed signs on the doors.
"So," said Scampton Tappet, "now that you've bought me, what would you have me do?"
"Oh, yes, right." I dug a calling card from my pocket, wrote down the title of Landon's latest novel, Bananas for Edward, and handed it to him. "Do what you can, would you? And if you need anything, you can contact me over at Jurisfiction." Scampton Tappet raised an eyebrow, told me he would do the very best he could, tucked the jar containing his backstory under his arm, and vanished. I breathed a sigh of relief and glanced around. Thursday Five was regarding me with such a sense of abject loss and failure on her face that I thought at first she'd been hurt.
"Are you all right?"
She nodded and looked down. I followed her gaze. Lying at her feet was my pistol.
"Is that where it ended up after it was knocked from my grasp?"
She nodded miserably, her eyes brimming with tears of self-anger. I sighed. She and I both knew that this was the end of the road when it came to her cadetship. If Scampton Tappet hadn't intervened, I might well be dead. And she'd done nothing to prevent it.
"You don't have to say it," she said. "I'm manifestly not cut out for this work, and never shall be. I try to apologize, but I can't think of words that could adequately express my shame."
She took a deep breath, pulled the bow out of her hair, put it in her mouth, and then gathered up her hair in a ponytail again before retying it. It was just the way I did it, and I suddenly felt a pang of guilt. After all, she'd only acted in her morbidly peaceable way, because that's how she was written, as an antidote to the rest of the Thursday series. The thing was, the sex and violence nature of the first four books had been my fault too. I'd sold the character rights in order to fund Acme Carpets.
"I'd best be getting back to my book now," she said, and turned to go.
"Did I say you could leave?" I asked in my stoniest voice.
"Well, that is to say, no."
"Then until I say you can go, you stay with me. I'm still undecided as to your fate, and until that happens, Lord help me, you'll stay as my cadet." We returned to Jurisfiction, and Thursday Five went and did some Pilates in the corner, much to the consternation of Mrs. Dashwood, who happened to be passing. I reported the Minotaur's appearance and the state of the Austin refit to Bradshaw, who told me to have the Minotaur's details and current whereabouts texted to all agents. After returning to my desk, dealing with some paperwork, and being consulted on a number of matters, I drew out Thursday Five's assessment form, filled it in, and then checked the failed box on the last page before I signed it. I folded it twice, slid it into the envelope, and wavered for a moment before eventually placing it in the top drawer of my desk. I looked at my watch. It was time to go home. I walked over to Thursday Five, who had her eyes closed and was standing on one leg. "Same time tomorrow?" She opened her eyes and stared into mine. I got the same feeling when staring into the mirror at home. The touchy-feely, new-age stuff was all immaterial. She was me, but me as I might have been, if I'd never joined the police, army, spec ops, or jurisdiction. Perhaps I wouldn't have been any happier if I'd connected with the side of me that was her. But I'd be a lot more relaxed and a good deal healthier.
Do you mean it? She asked.
Wouldn't say it if I didn't. But remember one thing. It's coffee and a bacon roll.
She smiled. Right, coffee and bacon roll it is.
She handed me a paper bag.
This is for you.
I peered inside. It contained Pickwick's blue and white knitted cozy. Finished. Good job, I murmured, looking at the delicate knitting enviously. Thank. But she'd gone. I walked to the corridor outside and dug out my travel book, turned to the description of my office at Acme Carpets, and read. After a few lines, the air turned suddenly colder. There was the sound of crackling cellophane, and I was back in my small office, with a dry mouth and a thirst so strong I thought I would faint. I kept a pitcher of water close by for just these moments, and thus I spent the next 10 minutes drinking water and breathing deeply.